The cyber landscape is constantly evolving, creating new challenges and opportunities to defend against sophisticated attacks. At Northrop Grumman, we provide a wide range of capabilities to stay ahead of these threats. To learn more, visit northropgrumman.com/cyber.
Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report's weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. I'm your host, Vagn Radian. And it's our honor to welcome today the co-chairs of the Cyberspace Solarium Commission, Senator Angus King, the Maine Independent, and Representative Mike Gallagher, the Wisconsin Republican. Gentlemen, thanks so much for joining us.
Great to be with you. We're looking forward to it.
Great to be here. Can I be an independently minded Republican if Angus is an independent?
Okay. Sir, you're welcome to affiliate any way that you'd like at this point. I think you've earned that. I'm sorry that we weren't able to do this in person, but both of you have been very kind to join us over the past year since the Solarium Commission was unveiled. And in fact, that for many people, that was the last event before things got a lockdown. And God willing, the first event they go to will also be a cyber event, given the importance of cyber and how it's been highlighted over this past year of lockdowns. Before we start, our podcast sponsor is Bell Leonardo DRS. Sponsors our global coverage. Northrop Grumman sponsors not only our weekly cyber report, but our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage. General Atomics Aeronautical Systems sponsors our coverage of strategy. And Beretta USA sponsors our land warfare coverage. Senator King, a lot of legislation has passed, and you guys should be really, really proud. For example, your one throat to choke concept, the National Cyber Director, who's yet to be named, but that's now legislated. But there were also some key elements that have not moved ahead. For example, the reorganization of congressional committees, that's equally important. And indeed, there is a concern among some that the case, are making the case that more centralization isn't the answer. And some worry that, like so many well-intentioned and extremely well-crafted strategies, there may not be actually the oomph to implement all of the stuff that we need to do as new breaches continue to happen, for example, SolarWinds. Are you satisfied with the pace and the scope of change, and what are the priorities over the next 2 years, given the commission has been extended?
Well, given the history of most commissions, we're delighted with the pace. We had a few over 50 recommendations in the report that was released last March, and 25 or 26 of them were enacted into law in December. That's a world record, both in terms of the number of recommendations that were implemented, as well as the speed in which that happened, a matter of 7 or 8 months. So we feel very good about that. Now, are we done? Absolutely not. There are a number of important recommendations yet to be implemented or to be executed upon, one of which is the international piece. We really need a leader in the State Department on the issue of cyber. We want someone who wakes up every morning thinking about how do we protect the United States and work with our allies and adversaries, frankly, to develop norms and guardrails around cyber on the world stage. We can't deal with this issue by ourselves. It is, by definition, an internationally based issue. So there's plenty left to do. I think we made some real progress. And I would take issue a little bit about the question about centralization. We're not trying to centralize, but we're trying to coordinate and harmonize, I think is a better word. And the problem was that we had a whole lot of cyber silos around the United States government and in the private sector. They're really excellent silos, but they're still silos. And so what we tried to bring with the National Cyber Director is a greater level of coordination, information sharing, and we've got to continue to move in that direction. I think another, I won't filibuster here to use a word in current discussion, but another area has to be the really deepening of the relationship between the government and the private sector, because the target space, 85% of the target space in cyber is in the private sector. And we really need to really step up building relationships of trust so that we can have information sharing, threat sharing, pen testing, so that everybody knows who's safe and who's not. So plenty of work left to be done. But if you'd have told me last March that we were going to have half of our recommendations in law by the end of the year, I would have taken that deal anytime.
Look, I think the progress has really been spectacular, and I didn't mean, but I'm just saying that some of these voices are saying, hey, you know, this centralization idea is not a good one. Although I fully endorse what it is you guys are trying to do, and I think many others in the field also do. Mr. Gallagher, can you walk us through, right? Senator King just mentioned the importance of the State Department's Cyber Bureau. You guys also want to drive in this next tranche the National Cyber Crime Center. Why are those initiatives so important from your standpoint, right? And what is on your to-do list? Because I know disinformation is on that as well. We're going to talk about that in a moment. But what are some of your priorities and why you think they're so important?
Yeah, well, let me maybe take those in reverse order. I mean, you can think of the National Cybercrime Center as a victim recovery center. You know, when your grandmother loses $10,000 to a Nigerian prince because she clicked on the wrong link on an email, now, who does she call in that environment? And that's how we envision the National Cyber Crime Center. It's about recovery. It's kind of your 911 or your 119 or 211 for cyber crime. Just given that this is such a pervasive problem that affects not just people working at DOD or state, but you know everybody, people here in Northeast Wisconsin, people in Maine, et cetera. On the first thing, the State Department Cyber Bureau, I think the need for that is a bit more obvious. I mean, if we look at kind of the geopolitical landscape, we are really facing incredible challenges from China in particular, but China and Russia more broadly, and just the sheer amount of resources that they have marshaled in the cyber domain is very troubling. And it's going to require us to step up in all instruments of U.S. national power, but particularly with our diplomatic instrument of national power. And, you know, that recommendation is intended to force the State Department to prioritize cyber because we want the State Department to take the lead when it comes to building a coalition of like-minded partners and allies, which at the end of the day, maybe this goes beyond the bounds of the report, but I'm sure Senator King is similarly minded. I think that's our secret weapon when it comes to competition with China and Russia, that we have a deep pool of allies and partners that we can draw upon. And if we work with them, if we get on the same page when it comes to how we engage and norms of behavior in cyberspace, well, then we really can start to effectuate good outcomes and compete effectively against countries like China and Russia that don't share our interests. And so, you know, we took a long look in this report at how do we ensure that the State Department has the resources it needs to prioritize cyber issues. And this is part of that broader effort to enhance our diplomatic efforts in cyber and ultimately establish and maintain and enforce norms of responsible behavior in cyberspace.
Let me chime in there on that if I could. I had an interesting experience a couple of years ago. I went to the Shangri-La Defense Forum in Singapore. And, you know, the forum itself had some big plenary sessions and they were okay, but not all that fascinating. But I must have had 15 at least what they call bilaterals, which were meetings with individual leaders of individual countries, mostly in the Asian region. What I came away from that was that China has customers and we have allies. That a lot of these countries, you know, they do business with China. They have to because it's in their neighborhood and China is such an enormous economic player. The vibe was, but we are friends. We want to be America's friends and allies. And I think that's an important distinction. And it's something we shouldn't lose sight of. It's a huge advantage to us. Churchill once said, the only thing worse than fighting with allies is fighting without allies. And, you know, that's something that I think we've absolutely got to continue to work on. I want it so that a cyber criminal I want them to not be able to go to Monte Carlo as well as Miami. I want worldwide sanctions, not just U.S. sanctions.
Let me ask about what this norms-based order would look like. The Biden administration is remaining as tough as the Trump administration, and perhaps in a more joined up way in terms of China. The Taiwanese representative was invited to attend the president's inauguration, which was a very powerful signal. There's a lot of talk about the importance of human rights. Tony Blinken, Jake Sullivan have all talked about the importance of coming together. And in fact, the administration's message to the Chinese has been, we're conferring with our allies and partners before we decide to address any of your issues, which is a positive sign. So what does an international norms-based order look like, especially in the wake of the SolarWinds attack, where Russia penetrated a software company in order to then get into government and networks, right? I mean, there's a sense that that was an intelligence operation and not an existential strike. We can talk about the strike in a minute, but since you guys are talking about a global cyber norm order, what does that global cyber norm order look like?
Well, I think that's a good example. The idea is that there would be a collective response, a worldwide response. We're talking about developing a kind of Geneva Convention of cyber, of what are the norms, what are the guardrails, and if they're violated, it won't be just the victim country that responds, but it'll be countries around the world. As I mentioned, a sanction is more effective if it's applicable everywhere rather than just in the U.S. or wherever. And so that's really, I think, at the heart of what we're talking about. And we're trying to shape behavior. We want to get to the point where internationally, including potential adversaries, subscribe to a system that will protect everyone, including them. That will change behavior in terms of whether or not they're going to engage in these kinds of activities. But I think the core of the idea is that a multilateral response will be much better in terms of actually fending off these kind of attacks. The best cyber attack of all is the one that doesn't occur.
Mr. Gallagher, you were a Marine intelligence officer. You served in the CENTCOM theater, but you did two tours in Iraq as well. How bad was this Russian attack? Was classified information compromised? And ultimately, how does the United States need to respond to it, both internally as well as externally?
Well, I think it was extremely bad. This is probably one of the biggest cyber espionage campaigns that we've ever witnessed. And I think what is remarkable about it, not in a good way, is that, you know, it was FireEye, not the federal government, that first identified the hack. And I think that shows both the importance of strengthening public and private partnerships for collective defense, as the senator talked about. And also, you know, the hard reality that the U.S. government, as currently constituted, is not organized to successfully defend itself or our critical infrastructure in cyberspace. And I suspect it's going to be a while, months, if not years, before we understand the full damage of the attack, just like we're still truly understanding and dealing with the consequences of the OPM hack, which compromised, you know, my military records and the military records of millions of others. So it's bad. I really don't know how to put it in starker terms. I just would say, I think it, not to be too self-promoting here, but we certainly believe that there are a number of recommendations in our report, some of which just got passed into law, that would have helped, if not prevented entirely. Notably, strengthening CISA's ability to do persistent threat hunting on .gov networks, you know, funding CISA's hunt and incident response teams to prevent against hacks like this. And of course, the establishment of a national cyber director who could, you know, be that point of outreach to the private sector where so much expertise lies. So yeah, this is bad. You know, 2020 was already a bad year. And then this was sort of the icing on the cake. Though 2021 is really giving 2020 a run for its money right now.
President Biden, in his first call with Vladimir Putin, highlighted this as an issue. How tough does the United States need to be in responding to this? Or is this a situation, you know, we talked to Mike Rogers, Admiral Mike Rogers, former NSA director and cybercom commander. And he said, look, I mean, this was kind of a, it falls into the category at this point of sort of a legitimate espionage operation. Obviously it's ongoing. Obviously everybody is looking for leave behinds and cyber munitions and all of that stuff. I mean, is this, how does the United States need to respond to this, maybe Senator King? And then would like to get your sense on that too, Mr. Gallagher, right? I mean, how do we, do you let it go? Do you punish them? If this was not prohibited behavior, can you punish them? Or is this, as you said, Mike, right? We just have to work on building up our defenses and getting sharper at the game. Like how, Senator King?
Well my first thought is, I'm not so sure this was pure espionage. And I don't, I'm not betraying any intelligence that I've seen. The sort of conventional wisdom around the community is that it was espionage, you know, garden variety, you know, stealing secrets. But it bothers me that my instinct is they went to an awful lot of trouble. I think there's a danger that there's malware left, that there are, I think you use the term cyber bombs left in some of these systems. So I think that it's potentially even more serious than we originally have thought. Again, I'm not betraying any intelligence. This is more instinct on my part, but it's concerning. And frankly, if they didn't, they could have. And that's concerning. So the question is, how do we react? The first way we react is by the president's phone call, by raising it with Vladimir Putin and saying, you know, you got to cut this out. Heretofore, we have been very reluctant to confront adversaries in situations like this, and we have not imposed costs. And that's one of the themes of the Solarium report, is that we have to be prepared to impose costs to make our adversaries think twice about doing something like this. If all they have to worry about is how many hackers they have to hire, and by the way, I did a calculation, Putin can hire 8,000 hackers for the price of one jet fighter. There's got to be more deterrent. There's got to be a place where someone at the table at the Kremlin says, boss, I don't know if we ought to do this, because if we do, they're liable to whack us. And that hasn't been the case. We haven't had a clear declaratory deterrent policy. And that, I think, is one of the, I hope, is one of the highest priorities of this administration, to develop that policy, to put our adversaries or possible adversaries on notice that if you attack us in this way, even though it's below the level of the use of force, there will be a response. It doesn't have to be cyber necessarily. It may be sanctions. It may be other diplomatic tools. Who knows? But right now, it's a cost-free operation for them. And why wouldn't they keep doing it? And, you know, I think SolarWind is an example. They clearly didn't feel that they had too much at risk. So I feel very strongly that one of the most important recommendations that we've made and that the country needs to execute on is developing a deterrent policy that will impose costs on adversaries, demonstrate that we have the capability right. And the will to do so.
And I should point out to the audience, you're a Select Intelligence Committee member. Mr. Gallagher, I mean, your sense, your PhD was, you know, height of the Cold War, where deterrence and deterrent and strategic thinking were critical, right? If we were thinking strategically, we would be investing these kind of small sums to give us big cyber kind of payoff, right? I mean, there's a bigger battle whether or not there are going to be five more F-35s in the budget than whether CISA has the resources it needs. What do you think is the right way to do this punitively, but as well as at home?
Yeah, well, first, let me just foot stomp what Senator King said, because even if this was just a hack, not an attack, or pure espionage, it's still one of the biggest espionage campaigns in history. It's still the hack of the decade. And, you know, if they have access to the networks, this means they could effectively control the networks, alter data, manipulate data to mess with us and create effects in the real world. I mean, 2/3 of the Department of Energy's plant sites and offices use solar winds to monitor networks. Think of the havoc you can create with access to that network. So I just emphatically agree with what Senator King said about, you know, nothing is not a cool hand in this case. Something must happen, even if this is below the use of force threshold. And I honestly think it starts with naming and shaming. I mean, clearly identifying, right, and not just, you know, saying to Putin, shame on you, but going below that level and getting specific, you know, whether it's cozy bear or fancy bear. I mean, I think we really need to send and constantly send a strong signal that you can't get away with this cost-free. And that kind of gets to the second part of your question about the key differences between deterrence and cyber and sort of strategic nuclear deterrence as we practiced it in the Cold War and to some extent still today. I mean, you know, there's really zero room for failure when it comes to strategic nuclear deterrence, and sort of the whole purpose was to avoid war. In cyber, you can kind of flip that on its head, and you start off from a recognition that deterrence, particularly below the use of force, is constantly failing. And so over time, you gotta build up a respectable posture of deterrence. It's not an easy thing to do. It certainly is not an easy thing to do, but particularly since so much of our assets and our weapons and our tools are not in the Department of Defense, or they're not even in the federal government, they're in the private sector. And that's something we spent a lot of time thinking through. And I think if you read our report, you'll find at least an attempt at a balance between the government doing more, because it must do more, but also the government being a productive partner with the private sector, where most of this competition is occurring on a day-to-day basis.
Let me go to the issue of disinformation. That's obviously on your agenda. Senator King, the January 6th insurrection was the founding fathers' worst nightmare, a president inciting a mob against the first branch of government to remain in power. The insurrectionists were a radicalized group that may be far, far larger than we think now. Obviously, President Biden has asked intelligence organs to sort of study the size of this problem, but they were also incited by a lie of a stolen election. And they were primed on a diet of disinformation by some of the nation's leading political leaders, including some of your colleagues, ultimately, that sort of played into the whole narrative that they have come to believe over decades. What's the right way to fight disinformation and the domestic extremism it fuels, given that at this point, these are really existential threats to the republic?
Well, I think you characterized what happened exactly right. It was, I spoke on the Senate floor the night of the insurrection. And one of the things I said was, I don't approve of what they did. I don't support what they did. I in no way endorse what they did, but I understand why they did it. They did it because they had been told for months that something had been stolen from them and that they had no recourse, that they couldn't trust the courts, they couldn't trust the press, they couldn't trust election officials across the country, they couldn't trust the politicians. So they were only left with violence as an option. To me, what happened that day was entirely predictable because these were people that have been basically fed a gigantic lie, and they believed it. And it came from their leader, the person they believe in and trusted. So the question is, what do we do? And, you know, we're a country with the First Amendment. We're a country that believes in free expression. And, you know, Jefferson saying we don't have to worry about error as long as truth is able to combat it. But we can't just let this kind of thing continue to happen. And it sounds sort of, you know, homely, but in our report, we talk a lot about education. I really think that we need to redouble our efforts in the digital age to educate kids starting in, you know, the first and second grade about how to work the internet responsibly, how to sort out truth from fiction, how to seek out various points of view in order to determine what the truth is and what the facts are. And that's one of the problems. We don't have that now. We have to train our American citizens to be better consumers of information. And frankly, I think that, you know, the computer revolution came on us so fast that we got the technology before we got the sort of mental software of how to use it responsibly. So I think you characterize it exactly right. And I'm it sounds sort of soft, but I really think the only answer in the long term is building better consumers of information who are more able to determine what the truth is and less likely to fall for a lie.
I know that you're going to have to leave us in a couple of minutes, and I think Mr. Gallagher has got a couple of more minutes he can give us. So I'm going to ask you this follow-up. But in the immediate sense, there is a fear that heavily armed groups, some of whom were at the Capitol, right, intelligence agencies are warning there could be more acts of violence. The last time we had a terrorist attack, we went to a $4 trillion 20-year war that Captain Gallagher fought in. At the end of the day, on a more immediate sense, how do you fight the extremism challenge? Because overseas, as sad as it is to say it, we killed a lot of terrorists. The re-education part of it didn't happen until Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates and some of our allies started to sort of advocate for a more moderate form of Islam that eventually resulted in folks being okay with the, alliance with Israel, right? I mean, how do we do this, both in the near term,
until we can
wait 20 years to re-educate people?
In the near term, the really sad part is that we've still got a gigantic fence around the entire Capitol complex, and we've still got thousands of National Guard troops. I mean, in the near term, we have to defend ourselves. I took a walk on Sunday up to the Capitol, and it broke my heart to look at the United States Capitol through a chain link fence with armed troops in camouflage, walking the perimeter. That's an awful admission of a failure of our system to engage its citizens in the basic functioning of the way it works. So in the short term, we've got to defend democracy. In the longer term, I think that the next step is the people who perpetrated that attack and who participated in it have to be held accountable. They have to be prosecuted and if they broke the law, brought to justice. If you rob a house and you know that you're not going to be arrested and tried, then you're going to keep robbing houses. So there has to be some consequences. And of course, the ultimate test of this is we have an impeachment trial that began recently, just in the last few days, in the United States Senate to determine whether the president himself bears a significant responsibility for bringing that crowd to Washington and sending them to the Capitol. That if indeed that's what he did, and we don't know yet exactly what he knew that morning when he talked to the crowd in terms of what their proclivities were, what the intelligence said. But if he knew that they were dangerous and bent on violence, and he sent them up there anyway, then he bears a significant amount of responsibility. And that's going to be the subject of this trial.
And Senator King, have you decided on what way you're going to vote yet, whether to convict the president or not?
I want to hear the evidence. I'm particularly interested, as I mentioned, in what intelligence he had that morning. What did he know about the volatility of the group that he was addressing? And secondly, I want to know what he did that afternoon in the White House as this attack was taking place. Did he countenance it or was he shocked as everyone else was? And I think those are two important pieces of evidence that we don't have yet. That I hope will come out in the trial, and I'll make my decision after hearing the arguments and seeing the evidence.
And certainly timelines do show a correlation that the rhetoric was actually driving people that were surrounding the Capitol, right? I mean, may have pushed them over the edge, but obviously that would be something that would be the trial.
When you send a tweet in late December that says, see you in D.C. on January 6th, it will be wild. That there's not too much left to interpretation there. And I think the other thing that's important is January 6th was not a random date. This wasn't a rally that sort of went wrong. This was a date when the president and the leaders of this, what turned out to be a riot, knew was a constitutionally important date when the Congress was certifying the final results of the presidential election. So this was a direct attempt to stop the certification of the election And it was an arrow at the heart of our democracy. And those are facts that I think are important. As you can tell, I think this was an egregious action by the president, but I do want to reserve the opportunity to hear from his lawyers to learn the details of the timeline and get whatever additional evidence comes forth at the trial.
Mr. Gallagher, you fought extremism as I mentioned when you, as a Marine intelligence officer. How do we do this when so many of your fellow party members, if not believe this for political reasons, feel like they have to keep propagating this myth of a stolen election that's then amplified by the media streams that a lot of these folks listen to, right? What's the right approach, both from the standpoint of more truthful messaging on which leadership depends, and the cyber and other elements that will be required to fight this, right? I mean, we've seen a lot of cyber sleuthing by citizens around the nation in order to try to help identify the perpetrators, right? What's the yin and yang of this? What's the messaging change that has to happen? What's some of the technological and other national means, right? I mean, because there are going to be legislative questions here to turn some of this eavesdropping capability against Americans, given most of it is actually focused overseas against foreign extremists.
Well, I think your question really kind of gets to the heart of the problem. On January 6th was really the lie at the heart of January 6th was, you know, whether it was the president or some of my very ambitious colleagues telling millions of people that somehow the vice president was going to snap his fingers and we're going to change the result of the election. And I think a lot of people maybe made a tactical and tragic miscalculation that, you know, they could use the spotlight for a couple hours of contested debate on the House and Senate floor in order to, you know, quote unquote, fight and, you know, draw attention to election irregularities. But the problem is it went way beyond that. I mean, there were people, thousands, millions of people praying on January 6th and in the days leading up to it that somehow Congress was going to overturn the results of the election. And of course, that is not what January 6th is about. I mean, if it is, then that would be an incredibly progressive interpretation of the Constitution and January 6th, one that would shock me coming from conservative mouths. But indeed, that's where we arrived. And I think in the months leading up to it, I, like many people, struggled to deal with the amount of complaints I was getting from constituents, very good people, smart people that were just concerned about what they were reading online and seeing on TV and struggling to make sense of what's true and what isn't. And not to dissolve or absolve some of my colleagues of the blame, but I think part of this is also we live in a media ecosystem where we don't have like a common source that we all trust for facts and dispassionate analysis. And so we're all untethered from a common reality. And that makes it very hard to sift through a lot of these claims. And it creates a fertile environment for demagogues and disinformation to thrive. And that's why what Senator King said about civic education and K-12 education is so important, because it's going to require a level of civic literacy and digital literacy that, quite frankly, we don't have right now, and the K-12 system is not delivering. Because I, as a member of Congress, sometimes, you know, someone would forward me a video of, you know, what looks like someone deleting ballots in Georgia. I'm like, I don't know if this is true or if this isn't. And I, you know, we don't have the time to sift through all of these wild claims on Parler and Facebook and all these forums. And in an environment where nobody trusts an AP fact check or a Washington Post fact check,
right,
that's very difficult. It's very difficult to have a reasonable conversation about very important issues when we're so disconnected from a common reality. And so maybe that doesn't make any sense, but to me, it comes back to education and sort of education around how elections work and things like that.
Doesn't it undermine the credibility of lawmakers? I mean, you were not part of the 147 who voted to disenfranchise people just mere hours after the seat of American democracy was desecrated. And you did make an incredible and very impassioned speech that I would submit folks to read. Right. I mean, at the end of the day, folks still voted for a lie. And there are a lot of folks who are looking at some of those members and saying, well, wait a minute, you guys are key members of the caucus. How can we, you know, if you can't tell fact from fiction on something that simple, how can you be kind of trusted to make bigger decisions? Right. I mean, so first, is there a bigger problem? And the second thing is, how do you fight this legislatively? Right. There will have to be changes in law. Because our intelligence networks since the 1960s, and you know, you could go back to errors that were made then, made it much, much harder to direct these capabilities against the public. And in fact, there are a lot of people who are bordering tinfoil hat on that stuff alone.
Yeah, it's a very difficult balance because, you know, as much as I disagreed with the objectors in the week leading up to it and wrote various op-eds explaining why I disagreed, you know, politicians have always, had a flexible relationship with the truth. And I don't think you can pass a law that says, you know, a senator or member of the House can't go on the House floor and say stuff, even if I disagree with their analysis and think it's dangerous. I think that's a very dangerous precedent to set if we go down this path of we're going to censure all of our colleagues, because then you can find examples on both sides. And, you know, there's really no end to that. So the one constant in all of this, I think, has been political opportunism throughout the decades. I think the change has been the way in which technology has given life to disinformation. And that's a very difficult balance to strike, because I do worry that, you know, sort of knee-jerk attempts to shut down platforms or kick people off platforms will actually just exacerbate this problem, right? It'll create a sense of victimhood. It will further drive us apart, or it will create more silos of information, right? You don't want all the conservatives living in Parler universe and all the liberals living in Twitter universe, because then we just live in different universes, right?
But aren't we you know, already sort of there?
We might be. I just think it's citizenship in the 21st century is just placing more demands on individual citizens to be educated and understand what information they're consuming and think for themselves.
Mike, I think you've really hit the right tone. And one of the problems we have is what I call the balkanization of the news business.
Yeah.
And the concept called confirmation bias, where there are so many sources of information and people, it's human nature, everybody does it, to seek out news sources that tend to reinforce wherever it is you're coming from in the first place. And the result of that is that we really have people, our country is, people are living in different factual universes. And my experience in public policy is, if you can have agreement on the facts, it's pretty easy to get the policy right. If you don't have agreement on the basic facts of whatever the situation is, it's almost impossible to get to the policy answer. And there are millions of people in the country right now who are absolutely convinced, as a matter of fact, that the election was stolen, their candidate was a victim of fraud, et cetera, et cetera. There's no factual basis for that, and there were ample opportunities to find the factual basis, but they still believe it, to the point where, you know, Senator Hawley and Senator Cruz basically said, because people believe the election was stolen, we've got to go through this stopping this election process. It was kind of a bootstrap circular argument, not because the facts there was fraud, but because people think there was fraud. Well, people think there was fraud because they were told there was fraud. So
right.
It's a very difficult situation that we have. The world was much simpler when everybody got their information from Walter Cronkite. I can attest to that.
Or from Angus King, if you were in Maine.
Right. I have to say, right, at the end of the day, in the past, you could argue we were better informed by fewer, more responsible sources of news, and that there was a general agreement on what was true or not, and we would separate opinion. Mr. Gallagher, I'm going to push back a little bit. You know, I don't have any modern historical parallel for 147 members in the wake of something like this saying, you know, sort of endorsing the lie that propelled it was a little bit, I think, different than what we've seen, as opposed to an opinion based.
Before Mike answers, I do have to drop off. I'm due at a hearing 5 minutes ago. So,
understood,
thank you,
sir. Thank you so much for joining us as always.
Glad to do it.
Thank you, Senator.
Now Mike can tell you how things really work.
Yeah, that's right.
So, very, very briefly though, I just want to push you on one thing, right? What are some legislative changes that will be required if we need to, you know, do greater intelligence surveillance of domestic extremists that we've historically tended to do less of a good job on, in part because the bandwidth has been focused outside our shores?
Well, let me caveat. I mean, we're going outside the bounds of the Cyberspace Solarium Commission. So there's very few recommendations that we have on domestic surveillance. I mean, we talk about this, as I mentioned before, from an education perspective, you know, expanding the FBI's Cyber STEM program, CISA's cybersecurity education training program. We have a whole section on election security, how the federal government can work, you know, better with the nonprofits in this space, combating disinformation, you know, how we can solve a variety of other election related problems, how the federal government, you know, while it does not have primary constitutional authority over elections, should promote auditable paper trails in our elections so that we're not too reliant on machines and digital technology that can be hacked and corrupted. But you know, when we talk about this issue of surveilling domestic extremists, we're sort of outside the bounds of the commission's purview. That being said, you know, I know the people that have been tapped to lead the domestic extremism review for the Biden team. Josh Geltzer is a phenomenal human being and a very smart guy. We disagree on a lot of stuff, but has high integrity. So I'm eager to see kind of what they come up with. I do think a lot of this on the disinformation side and less on the domestic extremism side, because we do have, you know, we do have mechanisms through which the FBI legally and operating with a warrant can monitor people that are no kidding criminals and extremists. But when it comes to disinformation and tech and these platforms, really the heart of the debate right now in Congress is over Section 230 and how we treat these tech companies as a matter of law. And I think there's a lot of conservatives that want to just repeal Section 230 because they feel like that will fix this problem. I'm not yet convinced of that. I think there's a reform of 230 that's necessary, but I worry that if you completely eliminate it, it'll actually make the problem worse because these companies will now be liable for anything that's said on their platform. Therefore, they will be quicker to kick controversial voices off the platform for fear of being sued for what those controversial voices say, and will get less speech, more regulation, and a sense of suppression than we have right now. So I'll admit to you, I haven't figured out the perfect Goldilocks approach. Some sensible reform of 230, I have to believe, is possible. In the waning days of the Trump administration, I believe the Justice Department put out an attempt at that. But that should be, you know, besides getting out of the pandemic and a few other key issues, that should be at the top of the agenda for this Congress. And I think there's room for people of good faith on both sides to engage in that debate. The final thing I'd say is, you know, we kind of looked at this from the broader lens of geopolitical tech competition with China in particular. You know, the behavior of some of these companies, you know, Google in particular, has really dismayed me. They've exhibited no sense that they sort of think of themselves as American companies with American values. But as a practical matter, we're going to need to have a productive working relationship with our tech companies and the best and brightest that work in them, because that's really an advantage we have relative to China in this space. And getting there is going to be very, very difficult, particularly when you have Google refusing to work with the US military on drone programs at the same time it's rushing to open up AI centers in Beijing. How we bridge that cultural divide between the federal government and DOD and Silicon Valley is a very difficult but important question in this space.
30 seconds, last question. When you do a survey of U.S. military systems and subsystems and components, there are enormous cyber vulnerabilities across that enterprise. The more you study it, the more terrified you get. General Government Accountability Office did a terrific study on that as well. What are you guys doing to address that shortfall? Because it seems as though you know, DOD is making progress, but we are a long way from securing even systems that one would imagine would be secure systems.
Well, Shirley, we actually identified that problem in our original report, and we got what we believe to be a fix into this last NDAA, something called Section 1712, which requires DOD to identify cybersecurity challenges in new programs and in legacy systems, and to look for it in integrated network systems where one vulnerability can upset the whole apple cart. So we'll see if that is the effective nudge of DOD on this issue that we intended it to be. But certainly it's an incredible challenge because, you know, we're not going to go back to analog systems, you know, as much as I like Battlestar Galactica and, you know, it's the old systems that tend to survive. That's a shout out to all you sci-fi nerds out there. Our systems are going to be more complex, more connected, and we're going to be struggling with this issue for a while. You know, the final thing I'd say though is that, you know, as kind of tech heavy and system and complex as this conversation can get, at the end of the day, our biggest challenges in cyber and with all these complicated systems are human challenges, right? It's usually a human failure that compromises a network, whether it's an NSA contractor taking something out of the building he shouldn't, or someone clicking on a link that they shouldn't. You know, I'm a human intelligence officer by trade. And as we used to say, the problem with human intelligence is that it involves humans, and humans can do stupid things. We sort of look at this through a human lens, and a lot of the solutions or successes we're going to have really come down to whether we're able to recruit the best and the brightest to serve their country, either in a civilian capacity or in uniform, and help us solve these very difficult challenges.
Sir, thanks very much for joining us. Really appreciate it. It's always a treat having you on, and already looking forward to welcoming you back. Thanks again.
Well, we can do a full hour on Battlestar Galactica or, you know, something really nerdy. I know that your audience would love that.
I think we would. I'm an original Star Trek original series guy. Yeah, very much so. Battlestar Galactica, another thing from the childhood. Didn't Cotton Space 1999? I don't know if that's too obscure for folks out there, but I had an eagle. I had a corgi eagle that I used to play with.
Wow! It's amazing you survived this long, Vago. All right, thank you, my friend. Yeah.
Everyone is a contributor at Northrop Grumman, and every day is an opportunity to help defend our nation and our allies. Visit our careers page at ngc.com to learn about joining the Cyber and Intelligence Mission Solutions team.